This episode is brought to you by Envision Studio, the world's most powerful screen design tool. Unlock new dimensions of screen design with Envision Studio's adaptive layout engine, rapid prototyping, advanced animation, shared design systems, and more. Visit userdefenders.com/studio to get early access. I need to cut into the normal episode flow to tell you that if I was to grade my accuracy in this interview on an important topic Joe Johnston and I discuss, I'd have to give myself 2 D's. Reason being is because we talk about an important user-centered designer named Doug Dietz. I instead called him David Dietz. And I also said that he was a doctor when in fact he is a designer at GE. So even though it's humbling to interject like this, I'm glad I set the record straight on the outset. Thanks for your grace, Defenders, and please enjoy this incredibly inspiring interview.
We're always going to have those changing, evolving, new technologies are going to change how people work. But really, the core of the problem is we have to create an experience that solves or meets an unmet user need. And I think no matter how you go about doing that, they're going to have touch points that we know exist today, and they're going to have touch points that we don't know exist tomorrow. So we just have to make sure we build a system that allows them to do that efficiently and try to complete whatever they're trying to complete in a meaningful way. There are going to be ways we can leverage technology that might make that more efficient, but it shouldn't be the core. We shouldn't build an experience around that particular technology if it's not trying to solve a problem to begin with.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders, and welcome to episode 46. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. Today I got to talk to Experience and Service Design Director Joe Johnston. Joe is also known as Merle on the Twitters and elsewhere, which totally surprised me to discover that his nickname has nothing to do with the fact that he grew up on a farm. And thankfully, Joe is absolutely nothing like Merle from The Walking Dead. A great deal of our conversation revolved around empathy, which, as we all know, is critical when designing products for other humans. We also touch on the importance of good leadership, and I may or may not have called Steve Jobs' leadership style butthole-ish. Apologies in advance, loyalist. I'm so excited to share this one with you, Defenders, and I hope you enjoy this conversation with Joe as much as I did. I want to share this iTunes review that came through recently. This one is from Michael J. McLean. What's up, Michael? Michael's a wonderful listener, faithful listener, and he left this great review. He said, "Fight for the users, 5 stars. Best podcast on iTunes. Love all other inputs from user experience heroes, and there's awesome stories on how they became UXers, so we may be able to take the same path. Jason is an awesome host and person, as I'm able to talk with him and other guests through social media. If I have any questions or casual chat. Thanks, Jason, and fight on, brother." Thank you, Michael, so much, man. That means a lot. I appreciate you so much and just your enthusiasm for the show and what I'm doing here. So you keep fighting on too, brother, man. I can't tell you how much reviews like that mean to me. But if you feel like leaving one, I would greatly appreciate it. You can go to userdefenders.com/review and help me to fight on. Joe Johnston has over 18 years of digital experience with extensive knowledge creating digital and physical experiences. His skill set focuses on the user experience and the creation of these experiences to help clients quickly test and validate solutions. He's adept at navigating the rapidly evolving and shifting technological landscape, making intuitive decisions amidst information abundance, where sparse facts mingle loosely with data-drenched opinions. I love that. He's completed a wide variety of projects, performing duties that include experience director, advisor, consultant, digital strategy, experience design, service design, and front-end development. He believes experience design is driven by moments of engagement or touch points between people, brands, ideas, emotions, and memories that these moments create. His experience design philosophy is holistic in nature and takes into account all components required to create engaging and emotive experiences. A little known fact about Joe, he grew up on a farm raising sheep during the day and hacking on a Commodore 64 at night. That is awesome. Welcome to User Defenders, Joe. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I'm excited to be here. Should be a fun conversation for sure today.
I believe that wholeheartedly. And Commodore 64, my friend, that is way back.
Yeah, it was way back for sure. It was definitely had some convincing to do to my parents. You know, they had no idea what a computer was, let alone grabbing a Commodore 64 and then down in the basement banging away at it late at night. So it was some fun times for sure.
Yeah, I mean, personal computers were like $2,000 back then, or $3,000. I mean, it's crazy, right? It wasn't very entry. It wasn't very entry friendly.
No, it wasn't. And I had to convince. I did have to pay some of that out of pocket of my own, and that kind of helped out. You know, the farm life was a ability to me to actually earn some living too. So as a young kid, so I was fortunate enough to be able to pay for half of it and then convince my parents to pay for the other half. So it was a challenge, but it was fun. I think they got some use out of it too every once in a while. But I think even today, I'm still going back helping my parents with their computer like many other people do today.
I still wish I had my old Amiga.
Oh, yeah.
I love that thing. I learned a basic code on that. I was so impressed with myself when I figured out how to make her talk.
Oh, yes.
And make her say things. And I was like, man, this is so neat. I think that's where my love of technology really started. It was, wow, that whole cause and effect thing. Like, I can type some characters into this processor and I can hit enter or run, and then all of a sudden I can make the computer do something. Like, I was like, this is incredible. I feel so powerful.
Yeah, exactly. That was the one thing that led me to doing a lot of, you know, tearing apart of radios and other things. I just wanted to know how they worked, for one. And then I wanted to see if I could put them together again and make them do something different, which sometimes I was successful and most time I wasn't. So that was always a little bit of trial and error. But, pounding on that Commodore 64 with friends and doing some other things, you felt like you were a little bit in control and you could actually create something. And that's really what I really love to do, is actually create some things, get my hands dirty. And, you know, I'll be able to do that on a Commodore 64 back in the day, doing some things, but also love to, obviously being a kid, play some games on there too, the old classics.
Oh, yes.
So it was really fun to dive into those too, and to understand even how those things got to work too, which was fascinating. Then the whole floppy disk thing and all that fun stuff. Definitely reminisce for days on that stuff.
Oh, I know. I'm so nostalgic about that stuff. I think it's just neat. I mean, it's neat to be able to just kind of reflect back and just see how far the field has come, and to actually say, you know, I was there when this happened. You know, we're kind of like hipsters.
Yes, indeed. And the funny thing is, as you have been a part of some fun projects with some organizations, and sometimes they still use those nostalgic type of systems in place today, which is always a challenging thing in the work world today. So, but yeah, definitely it's been a fun ride to see it evolve from what we used to work on to seeing these huge supercomputers we carry around in our pockets every day.
Indeed. Merle. So I know there's a story there, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say that Merle is a nickname you acquired on the farm.
I wish it was. I wish there was actually a real backstory to that thing. No, it was, obviously being a part of the whole digital world and being a part of the internet when it was being created, you know, being in college and then, you know, living in the worlds of Napster and all that fun stuff. You know, it was actually, and again, we can go way back, so a lot of weird backgrounds that I have, like many of your other host, people that have been on, interviewers that have been on the show, but on the farm. But also, I grew up in Michigan. So being from Michigan, you know, hockey is a part of your life. I actually played on a hockey team and helped grow a small organization to play different types of other teams in the area. And they needed a website that they could actually put all the team schedules on, so they all knew when they were going to play and get some advertising. And this was early in the college years that I had. So I was like, hey, I can build a website. I know how to do that. So I got a URL, and they're like, well, we want to call it this. At the time, it was a roller hockey league. I played ice hockey and roller hockey, but it was like, I think it was the Michigan Elite Roller Hockey League. And that was the name they wanted. I was like, well, we can get a shorter name than that. So I abbreviated to MERHL. And so this was a long time ago. So I was like, hey, that's a pretty short URL. And then the hockey association disbanded. And I was like, well, I'll just keep it around. And then I just used it for my own stuff. So that's actually how it became to be. It was just a short, you know, 5-letter acronym that I just kept and used it for the rest of my days. And now it's stuck with me. So
wow,
that's the story behind it, weirdly enough. But it has taken on a life of its own for sure throughout the course of the years.
Yeah, no, that totally takes me by surprise. I was like, okay, farm and then Merle. And you think about like the Walking Dead character and like named Merle.
Yeah.
Who wasn't a pleasant guy, of course. But,
no.
But you know, the name was fitting for that kind of thing. But interesting stuff. You know, let me ask you this, Joe. Did you have a mullet?
No, I never did. I never was one. I had a lot of friends that did, though.
I had a lot
of friends. I was always the smaller kid of the bunch. You know, I did have some longer hair when I was younger, but nothing mullet style. It was always almost like one of those bowl cut kind of things half the time, and just kind of my parents got it cut when it got too long. So it was one of those things. But nope, never rocked the mullet. But I had some awesome friends that did. And they even have some, you know, wonderful hair today. If you saw my haircut, I don't have any now. So I'd be
awesome.
I'd be tremendously jealous of those that have mullets today. So,
well, you know, there's like, you know, if you Google, you know, names for mullets, there's like, somebody's done a lot of work to come up with really funny names. And one of them is hockey hair.
Oh yeah, definitely. So there's a whole story to that too. It's definitely a cult and culture inside of the hockey community, and I can go in depth for hours on that. And
can you give us a quick overview? Like
So obviously, you know, the whole playoff system, they grow their hair out, and everybody loves to have hockey hair, which is, you know, long hair, mullet hair. You can go in the 70s. They got some classics. It's awesome, old school, and when they didn't have to wear helmets, usually it was the best ones. But now today, the kids always want to refer to things in different ways, and it's taken upon of its own life. And there's a term for it inside of the hockey community for the kids that play, and they call it flow. So when you actually are out skating around and kids comment on the flow, they're referring to the hair as they skate by and that flows in the air. So it's actually still a widely used term, but they now have twisted it into the world we live in today. So it's pretty funny. I got quite a bit of stories. I'm actually a hockey coach too. I coach my son. He's 10 years old. So I got quite a bit of in-depth knowledge on that, wow, which we can even correlate to business today. So we'll get into probably some of that later. But yeah,
yeah,
hockey hair is a life of its own. It's a blast.
Interesting. It gives a whole new meaning to user flow too, when you think about it that way.
Oh yes, it does. It does.
So as you know, Joe, we take a fun superhero approach, and every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. And we got to a little glimpse of yours right now in the hockey background and the farm life. But let's talk about yours, like about your life now. Like, what do you like to do when you're not working, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of hit on a little bit, but, you know, I now live in just north of Atlanta. And, you know, having that farm background, we obviously don't live in the city with my wife and family. And I still play a lot of hockey. As I said, I play myself in an adult. We call that the beer leagues, which is perfect, which is exactly what it is. A bunch of washed up old guys playing. But it's the great thing I get to do is I actually have a 10-year-old son, like I said, that plays hockey. He's been playing since he's been four. And one of the best enjoyments I get out of working every day is being able to see these 9 and 10-year-old kids learn about the sport, but also learn about sportsmanship and actually how to work together as a team. And I think that is one of the greatest things I get to do for practice when I go drive home and put together and actually go to games and see the kids' excitement. It's one of the best things I get to do. And there's funny things you can correlate between that and obviously teamwork and other types of leadership activities. And actually the coaching you go through from USA Hockey actually breaks down how to maintain these 9 and 10-year-old kids on ice for an hour when they're all over the place, right? Which directly correlates to actually managing a room of executives when you think about it, trying to maintain the attention span of those while you present something. So it's really, really funny crossover there. But that's, you know, primarily what I love to do. Obviously, my wife and my kids spend a lot of time with them when I'm not working. And I'm a big internet information junkie. So as you probably seen from my social activity, I've put a lot of my thoughts and dive into a lot of things. I'm always curious, like my early career working with the Commodore 64 and diving into things. I'm always very, very curious how things work, especially in this new fun Internet of Things era. So it's always fun to explore those types of interactions. So that's what really gets me going is, you know, obviously my family and, you know, this life we live in this industry, which is ever evolving, which is really fun.
That's a great segue, Joe. Tell us your origin story. Now, you already kind of touched on the Commodore 64, but what inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever evolving field?
Yeah, you know, like I mentioned, I grew up on a farm, and to put it in perspective, in the rural southeast part of Michigan, my closest neighbors are my uncle and my grandfather. So,
wow.
Yeah, so it puts into perspective kind of the life we lived in. My entire family lived on farms. Had a grandfather had a large cattle farm, and we had sheep and all the other array of other things, and went to the 4-H and showed sheep and was a grand champion showman and all this fun stuff. So it was really weird, interesting life, more of the analog style, which really, I think, bleeds well into what we do today. And I think one of the big terms and one of the things we see in the industry is empathy. And I think raising a bunch of animals, understanding how to care for them and actually go through the process of going to a fair and showing them, it does bleed into that, putting yourself in someone else's shoes and going through that empathy process. So there's a weird twist to all this that kind of relates to what we do today. And I think that's a big part of what shaped me and my parents and you know, taking the responsibilities of having these animals and going through the process and even selling those animals and all that craziness. So it's definitely tied directly into getting into the world that we live in today and creating these experiences for customers, putting ourselves in their shoes and creating things for other people to use. So that's a weird twist on everything. And probably a lot of people don't even have a background or understanding of that. But I think it has really shaped me and what I do today as the world tends to evolve and even new technologies and being able to adapt to those. So it's really weird, funny stories in the farming life, but I think it translates pretty well.
No, that is very fascinating, Joe. I think that you made some really good points, and it may seem kind of odd, especially for folks who haven't lived on a farm or who haven't had to care for animals. But I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you have to really kind of, you know, make sure that they're fed, make sure they're warm enough. And it's a funny story. I have chickens here at my house. And last night I forgot to turn the heat light on, and it was like 15 degrees when I woke up this morning. And I was like, oh, and I kind of felt bad. Part of me was like, I kind of want them to die because they're old and they're not, they're not laying eggs for us anymore. But most of me was like, oh shoot, I kind of failed them. You know, I failed to take care of my animals, and I actually felt bad about it this morning. So I think that there's a lot to be said for that. And of course, having kids, which I know you're a father and you have three children, and it's, you know, that is a big empathy builder too. And being a husband, you know, or being a wife, you know, being married to somebody, that right there is like instant leadership lessons.
Most definitely.
And having a family, right?
Right, right. Most definitely. And I think all of those pieces of that come together. And I think there's a lot of things to learn. I mean, I've worked with a lot of different talented designers and user experience individuals and service design individuals and the wide variety of different pieces of our industry. And they all have this very unique background sometimes when you work with really, really talented individuals and you get a chance to see how they go about doing their day and really understand and break it down. And you'll see that they all have that core respect and empathy and understanding in a lot of different facets. And it even breaks down even more too. It's really interesting as I've grown through my career and I've learned and had some challenges understanding it, but it's also not only empathy with the individuals that we're creating at the end customer, but it's also the empathy you have with the business owners that you're working across the table with, understanding where their perspective is and what they have to do in their lives, because they probably have families. They want to get bonuses. They want to move the product forward. So there's also that interesting business side that you have to have empathy as well. And I think it takes a little bit of understanding to really get used to that once you start creating these types of large, you know, business experiences for a lot of people.
Yeah, that is so true. And I hearken back to when I started. It's like, man, I just felt like, and I just put a tweet out this morning too before our time, and it's just something that occurred to me. It's like, if you have to say, because I'm the designer, you've already proven that you're not.
Yeah.
Because design is about working with other people. It's about taking the humble approach. It's being a professional, of course, but you should be able to defend your work, of course, but you should also be willing to hear other people's perspectives, because that's when the best work is created. I think whenever you're not just designing in a tunnel or whatever, you're not just designing, you know, in a bubble, you're actually letting other people into the process and you're designing for those people. So I some of my biggest mistakes that I made, man, when I first started my career. And I think when I put that out there, I was speaking to myself too, because there were projects where like, I would get pushback like, well, you know, that's wrong. That's that's not a good choice of color, or that's not that element's in the wrong place. And it'd be like, hey, I'm the designer, you know, like I'm the guy that does this job. You just do your job of talking to customers, you know, and I'm ashamed and embarrassed to say that, but that's how it was for me when I first started. I needed a big dose of humility lesson. And that comes with time. It comes with experience. It comes with growth. But all that to say, like, empathy is the root. And I don't care how many people say it's overused, like, that is still the root of this field and of designing good experiences for the customer and the business.
Yeah, and I know. And it's in our industry, sometimes terminology can be used just as, the word bingo style of things. But I think that word's been used quite a bit. And I think hopefully it resonates well with everybody. It doesn't lose its power and impact when we start talking about empathy, because we're seeing it now more and more than we have ever before. And I think, you know, understanding what that really means in the context of everybody will really start to open a lot of different things. And the funny thing, I was just at a workshop on Monday doing a user experience, customer experience workshop for our organization. We showed a video, and you probably have seen it, It was a TEDx video talking about the MRI scanner. They changed that experience based on the individuals, the kids going into the scary experience, and they redesigned them. It was an interaction or industrial designer talking about how they've created a whole experience and make them not feel scared going into an MRI scanner. And that really, there's a part in that video that actually, if you don't end up tearing up just a little bit, there's something emotionally wrong with you. So it was it was fascinating to understand the empathy side of that. And then we had a crowd of about 25, 30 people, and half that crowd had to wipe away some tears. But that was the beginning of them understanding, we're getting into a customer experience, user experience workshop. That is what it's all about. It's understanding the empathy across all the touch points that someone would have, digital, on the phone, in person, whatever that might be. The understanding of that is very, very key. So yeah, I hope we always learn the impact of that on all facets of what we do.
I'm so glad you told that story, Joe. Like that is I love that story. And for me, stories like that, that's why I love design so much. I love the implication of how lives can be changed. And I have a huge heart for children. I mean, I've got six of them. I mean, I'm an overachiever when it comes to that. You know what I mean? Like, but I just love kids, and my heart, there's nothing that breaks my heart more than seeing kids suffer, or seeing kids just hurt or abused or things like that. And I just love that David Dietz was his name.
Yes.
And I know that because I made a note in my design inspiration Evernote about it, because I always want to remember that story. And he was the guy that kind of designed these machines and was observing. There's a lot of user experience lessons in that story. He exercised the superpower of observation, by the way, because he was in the room observing these kids just terrified to get in this thing. And I've had MRIs, and I have had to hit the panic button.
Yeah.
Because I hate small spaces. I'm claustrophobic, and I didn't want to do the drugs, before the thing. I thought, I can do this, I'm a man, I can do, I hit the panic button. So I imagine these kids that have to do this all the time, they have cancer or whatever, they have to keep going into this machine. I love the empathy that David Dietz expressed. He's like, I got to do something about this.
Yeah, and
I've got to make this more fun for kids.
Right, and one of the main things that he did to be able to do that, he realized, he had the understanding that, I don't have the perspective of a child in this scenario. Mm. How can I go get that? And I think he worked with the Children's Museum and a team there and actually co-created with parents and younger kids to actually start creating and designing and putting together his workshop with kids and with others. So he actually knew and took a second and understood his conscious competence of actually understanding of like, oh, I don't know everything. I may be an expert in designing this MRI, but I'm not. I know enough now that I don't know enough. Where do I need to go get it? And he actually worked with that Children's Museum, I believe it was in Milwaukee, I think, and started to really realize how kids think and how kids work. And really started to build an experience around that. And I think that's really the light bulb that goes off once you start to realize, oh, we need to gain this perspective. How do we get it? And that's when we go into our processes of, user research and understanding and testing and iterating and analyzing and trying to figure out what is their mental model? How do they look at things in their perspective? And I think that's really the key is, one, having the light bulb and initiative to say, you know what? I don't have this. I have to go get it. How do I go get it and build that? And then you start to become really knowledgeable about their inner workings, and then you can start creating these experiences that are going to be very, very powerful, no matter if they're affecting their life, like designing an MRI scanner or designing an app that does something different to sell a product. You still can do from that perspective. And I think that's the real kicker in our industry, is really understanding how that light bulb goes off in your brain to want to learn more about that perspective rather than jumping in and creating solutions right off the bat.
Oh, so good. Yeah. And David Dietz, the doctor who designed this thing, he's looking at this device that he created and seeing these kids, again, scared out of their minds, they go in this thing and looking at this, like it's an effective design. The machine itself was doing what it was designed to do, but there was an added layer that he didn't foresee of the terror of going into this like scary dark hole of, like beige colors and clinical,
Yeah.
And anyway, so he did something about it. That wasn't a failure because he actually learned from it and he did something about it. And I always say, like, if it ain't broke, break it and make it better. So I feel like, and this is kind of all leading into my next segment here, and it's about failure. Certainly when you were taking apart the radios and, the gadgets around the house and then trying to put them back together, even if you didn't know how to put it back together right away, I bet you learned a ton And I bet that, it, you know, eventually, you know, there's some things that you did at, you were actually able to put together, probably most of the things that you took apart. But those are all learning experiences. Those are not, it's not failure if you learn, if you're learning. So my next question and my next section is about failure and life altering experiences and transformations, because every superhero goes through that. And that's what makes them who they are and gives them that burden to help others, to kind of live their life and do their work in service to others. So I want to ask you, Joe, can you tell us a story about maybe what's been the biggest one in your career?
Yeah. And like you said, the failure process is challenging and emotional straining sometimes, but you have to look at it as a learning experience and even looking at it from a learning perspective. And I think we even chatted a little bit about that before even hopping on and other types of certain circumstances. But I think one of the biggest ones that impacted me was early on in my career. And I think I mentioned this a little bit too, was, you know, I worked at a organization and pretty large consulting organization. So it had pretty structured processes. And there were, it was early on in the, you know, digital design, user experience age. I was pushing the boundaries of what the correct user experience should be. Looking for that, you know, at the time coming out of school and, you know, understanding, oh, everything needs to be perfectly designed and not really, like I said earlier, looking at the perspective of everybody and the situation that you're in. So I tended to push rather passionately, let's say that, around the building the correct thing, doing it the right way, and then discounting what everybody else was doing as doing it wrong and not doing it right. So I had a lot of interesting conversations and got to the point where people were saying, hey, I don't want to work with Joe. He's too hard to work with, or he's not, you know, he isn't fun to work with, or he isn't willing to work together in certain things. And I think my passion of trying to push those things gotten away a little bit. So I learned going through that to start to understand and build that empathy and apply it not only to the customers that we deliver something to, but also the teams that you work with and the empathy of other individuals and understand the full scope of everything. So, which has changed me quite drastically over the course of my career working with different organizations, is really to quickly, you know, assess and understand everybody's perspective before jumping in and deciding what we think is right way to do some things. And it's always, you can kind of see that in our industry today. Somebody will make comments around, oh, this thing doesn't work this way, or it doesn't perform the way we think it should, because we're kind of experts in the industry and we know, kind of, oh, they should have done it this way. Well, we don't know all of the inner workings of why it was done that way. And there was probably decisions, because all of us, I think, would want to create the best experience possible. But it's always a challenge to get to that point. And it's a journey, and it's understanding the different steps to get in there with the teams and other organizations and how they work and how they export and how they do different things. So I think that was really a big thing for me to really take back. And had some very, very intimate conversations with some individuals around my particular attitude towards things. And I think that's what really flipped a switch in my brain. And really, I think at that point, I think I really expanded as a designer way beyond I thought I could. And it really started to digest all of these pieces and parts, which now really leads to, you know, working with these large organizations and how they work and doing a lot of different things. So I think that was a real big part of my career, working with that organization, understanding. And it was early on, so I was really kind of green coming out. And I think that's one notion to take with any, you know, designer that's looking to get into our industry or just coming out of school, is really take that perspective and, you know, have passion for what you do, but make sure you have the empathy and understanding of really everything that's going on, so you can really apply that to the solutions you're coming out with and really start to evolve a great experience. But that was one that I had that, I mean, I've had plenty, but that was one I could really resonate with that really changed my course of my career and thinking as I approach building teams, working with organizations and doing those things. It really, really bode well. I can tell you that from working with a lot of companies.
I'm sensing a theme here, Joe, and I love it. Empathy is at the heart of great design, always. So, and I think about my first leadership role in design.
Yeah.
I was like, I thought, well, Steve Jobs is like the most visible kind of design leader and obviously has some really great results. And I thought, well, I need to be like him. You know, I need to be like Steve Jobs. And you know what? That's the wrong way to lead. Okay. So yes, the guy was a visionary. Yes. He created some incredible, innovative products that have changed life as we know it, of course. However, he wasn't the best leader. And I think anybody who worked directly with him would attest to that. He was kind of an a-hole.
Exactly.
I think, yes, he got stuff done. He created some awesome stuff, but he's sort of like a one in a million, one in a 10 million, you know, whatever you say there. But anyway, I learned a lot, because that style of leadership, that doesn't work. You don't lead with fear. You lead with a servant's attitude. And that was a big lesson for me in leadership and design leadership. And I had to learn the hard way because I just, I was like, why aren't I getting results? Why aren't my people respecting me? Oh, because I'm a jerk.
Right. Exactly. The situation I was in was similar to that. And it's challenged to work that way for sure. I mean, obviously, I think some people have mentioned, oh, Steve Jobs made me a better designer because he pushed me in ways where, broke through the wall and got something. And some people are going to resonate that way.
Sure.
But most
sure.
people are going to take it a totally different way and not want to work in that way. And I think we're even seeing that more in today's world. A Steve Jobs-like individual can tend to destroy a company more than help it. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen that. I've seen it personally in a lot of my experiences where you might have an extremely talented individual, but one bad apple can spoil a bunch really, really quickly. And,
no pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. and change the culture of an organization in a direction that you don't want to change it. And even though you may want to have a certain strategy to something or a certain type of culture and you want to push upon that, man, culture itself is its own beast. And no matter what strategy you put in front of it, its culture is going to destroy strategy every day. So I think that is a big piece of what we do is not only build experiences for people, but we actually are great understanding individuals that learn how to build with teams. Once you get to that point of working with teams, building teams, whether with clients, co-creating with them, or building your own kind of product teams inside of organizations, understanding the skill sets of individuals and how they can leverage each other and work together to make a better group together, I think is really key. And that's another piece of seeing teams and growing teams. I know my skill sets now. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the four steps of the conscious competency model. You start to realize it's almost like being an expert model where you figure out, it's like, oh, I know enough to know that I don't know enough. And then you have to go realize what those are. But really being a part of understanding who you are and what you're really good at, then you'll start to expand and grow beyond your wildest imagination. So I know my core skill sets and I know who I have to work with, or maybe I have to go hire somebody or go get somebody to offset those skills that I don't have. And I think that's what great leaders tend to do is understand how they can be. Maybe they're a great innovator, but they can't manage for anything. So they need to go find that person to offset that. Or they're a great creative mind that can create everything, but they can't run a business. So they got to go with the business side of things. So for startups or for putting groups together, when you start working on projects, understanding and being really consciously competent about who you are and what you're good at and what you're not, you'll just grow tenfold and growing in teams because you'll learn a lot, but you'll also take advantage of everybody's core skill sets and grow them as well.
I love that, Joe. And I think of StrengthsFinders. I've done StrengthsFinders before, and there's a lot to that. I kind of want to take it again because I feel like, we evolve and hopefully we're getting better. We're either growing or dying. So I feel like I'd love to take that test again because I've grown a lot since I took it. But anyway, I still believe in the principles behind it. We are really good at certain things, each of us, but we're not really good at other things, but other people are. So I think that's the whole concept of putting that together and being who you are and going all in on that. And I think that's kind of like the whole Steve Jobs story. And I didn't mean to like harp on him so bad, but I mean, there's certainly lore around some of the leadership style, but here's the difference. He was being himself. That's who he was.
Yep.
And the difference with me is I was trying to be him. That was the problem.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So anyway, I love that, Joe. That's awesome. So with user testing, and I know that you've done your fair share of that through your career. Do you have any stories of anything crazy or super awkward that happened during any sessions?
Yeah, I've been through quite a few formal, informal, a wide variety of different types of user research. But I have to say, the one that sticks in my head the most was probably one that was the most beneficial, I would have to say. Maybe not the craziest, but one that was most beneficial in the project that we were doing. So the story goes, I was out on site doing a little bit of observational research. I was interviewing some individuals. This was a broker-dealer organization. So we were working with them to kind of build a better broker-dealer experience for them internally, but also for their customers. So I was interviewing the internal employees at this organization, trying to figure out what their day-to-day life was, what kind of the processes. It was a very process-oriented organization, and it had to be, follow all of the legal matters. So it was very, very strict, had to go through these steps in the process. So I was chatting with everybody, and they were all in this kind of like fishbowl room together, but I was going one by one, kind of just seeing what they were doing, obviously all the normal stuff, sticky notes on the computer, you know, ask some questions around that, you know, other types of process-oriented things. When I got to the final gal, she had the same thing, you know, the same sticky notes. And she was kind of the one that was the leader of the group inside of this fishbowl running the kind of process. I mean, this was a very financial institution, you know, not a whole lot of creativity going on. And there was this wooden ruler, old school wooden ruler with the thin little metal that you see creative people use all the time, right?
We
use every day. It's like, I got one on my desk right now and I love using it just to do wireframe stuff or do whatever we need to do. And I'm like, that's curious. I wonder why she has it there. I said to myself, I'm going to ask her at the end. I don't want to dive in too deep because she was explaining her processes on her computer and she was jotting some notes down and stuff. And then at style, I was like, well, is there anything else? And I go, yeah, I have one last question. I go, what's the ruler for? And then the entire room kind of started to laugh. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be good. So she goes, yeah, so the ruler, here's what I use the ruler for. She had her to-do list on her piece of paper. And it was very, like I said, very process-oriented. So everything that came in, like an account or something like that, she had to go through these specific steps. And she wrote all the steps down for that particular person. So she would take the ruler and align it to make sure she was in the order she needed to. She didn't skip any of her steps. So the ruler, she just used as a mechanism to align to go through her process, her to-do list. And she would move the ruler down every time she completed a step. That way she wouldn't forget it. I was like, wow, that's really interesting. I never would have thought that. So we leveraged that knowledge. And inside of the application, we created this little scratch pad to-do list inside of the application that was, one, documented, because from the legal matter, they had to document all the information. They had all these sticky notes all over the place, which from a financial institution, that's probably a little bit of a no-no. So they had to document all that and it was recorded. So inside of the system, we recorded that, but then we added this to-do list. So that actually increased their efficiency tenfold because now everybody could see the process that happened and no one would skip any of the steps, therefore making the process more efficient and more secure. So If I didn't ask what that ruler was, we would have never probably came up with that solution inside the experience itself. So that just goes to show those observational research methods come in extremely beneficial. And I know a lot today, everybody's relying on the plethora of data insights we collect, which gives you the what, but it doesn't give you the why. So I'm a big why person, so definitely balancing those. But that would probably be the best kind of outcome of an interview I've had, probably that one.
Defenders, curiosity is a superpower.
Yep.
It is. Use it. I love that, Joe. Like, just being aware and being curious. So it's, you're observing and you're also curious, and you had the boldness to ask a question. That's the other thing too. Be courageous. Be bold. There can be some stupid questions, but most of the time they're not.
Right,
okay?
Right.
So I think there's so many takeaways in that, and that you were able to use what you observed and what you saw to make a better product and to make their lives and their business easier, better. The only thing missing would have been like a cool UI with that ruler on it, right?
Oh yeah, right. Definitely, yeah. Well, that might be a next more physical product for them.
Phase
we can definitely,
two.
Yeah, we can do some IoT stuff with a ruler and scan some stuff in. That'll be fantastic. So
the elusive phase two.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, that's the other part of what we do. It's sometimes you have a passion for a particular product, and you know if you're in a product company, it's great. You can evolve the product over time, but I've worked in agencies and consulting world for a long time, and it's great. The variety is excellent. I think that's where, like you said, the curiosity and my driving force, I tend to gravitate towards those types of companies. But you do lose a little bit as you work with these companies for a while, and then you create something, hand it over to them, or at least give them an iteration of something so they can continue to grow it. And then you step away and move on to the next thing. So you don't get a chance to actually see it evolve over time. And that's always been a bit of a challenge for, I think, anybody in the industry. But I think hopefully we can start to change some of those things and give the tools to allow these individuals to kind of continue to do the next version. Like you said, the elusive phase two, what happens with that? So that's another part of what I'm doing quite a bit now too, is working with organizations and the plethora of different types of processes that they have, and helping organizations actually give the tools, kind of teach the teacher kind of scenario, and give them that empathy, give them that user experience knowledge to start to at least ask those questions. And I think you brought it up, the I love to ask why, and I've mentored a lot of individuals, and it's almost to a fault of mine sometimes. People get frustrated, but interesting story. You, if you continue to ask why, you'll really get to the crux of the reason why you're doing what you're doing. because one or two things will happen. You'll keep asking why, and they'll finally tell you the real reason, or you'll continue to ask why, and then they'll finally realize, you know what? I don't really know why we're doing this, which is a whole other problem in itself. So that in itself, I think, is a great tool to do no matter what kind of situation you're in. You're gonna find out a lot about the individual, but also about the project.
Oh, so good. It makes me think of a book that I read recently, and I love books. But there's a book called The Coaching Habit, and it's by a guy named, his name is really funny. It's Michael Bungay Stainer. But
wow.
It's a tough gig, but he's a great
kid. Had to be harsh on him. Wow.
Yeah. It's a great book. And one of the points that he made, it's a great leadership book, Defenders. Highly recommend reading it. One of the points that he makes in his book is if you're in a leadership role and you want to kind of get to, first of all, you want to get to the point when you call somebody in your office, you need to address something, just get to the point, right? I mean, there's always that kind of tension of, you know, beating around the bush and like small talk and, you know, it makes it more of a tense, nervous conversation. Just get to the point in a loving way. But the other point that he makes, and this is kind of what I was trying to touch on, is the awe question. And that's AWE. And what else?
Mm-hmm.
And what else?
Yep.
Oh, and what else? And you know, when you keep asking that question, you get a lot more than you would if you hadn't asked even one time. You get a lot more out of it, and everything becomes clearer for you and for your team, for your person on your team.
Yeah, those open-ended questions will get you a lot of insight that you wouldn't even realize. Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Coming soon from Envision, the design collaboration platform used to create the digital products you love. Envision Studio, the world's most powerful screen design tool. Unlock new dimensions of screen design with Envision Studio's new adaptive layout engine, rapid prototyping, advanced animation, shared design systems, and other game-changing features created to help your team design better, faster, together. Clark from Envision says, this is the design tool we've always wanted, and we're so excited to share it with you. Visit userdefenders.com/studio to get early access. Joe, what's your design superpower? And I dare ask that because I feel like you've really expressed a lot of it so far, but I dare ask that.
Yeah, you know, I think we hit it a little bit, is really starting to really dive deeper into that empathy side of things, putting myself in the individual shoes. Like I said earlier, it could be a wide variety of different perspectives. And then, you know, also being able to cast that vision of kind of what it should be in their eyes. So always tended to try to gravitate towards understanding what their, you know, needs are, and removing myself from the equation a bit to create that vision, I think is probably what a lot of these stories that I've talked about have led towards. And I think that's another big piece of it too, is as designers, we get so passionately attached to our designs and executions and somewhat become a child of ours. And sometimes we have to remove ourselves from that and say, well, we're not building it for us. We're building it for the other individual that's using it, whoever that might be.
Yes.
And again, I think that's another core skill that takes a while to really fully mature. And I still have, I think everybody has challenges with that, no matter the years of experience that you have. But just remembering that you have that perspective will make a better product in the end in a lot of different types of experiences.
Yeah, so true. And one of my super guests, Matt Griffin, a recent guest, said, if you want to be an artist, go be an artist, but that's not what a designer is.
Yep.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think I've seen another one where it's only art if you have to solve a problem. I think that's what design is, and art is necessarily just not defining or at least creating or solving a problem. So yeah, definitely would agree.
Joe, conversely, what's your design kryptonite?
Oh man, probably a lot of different things. But I think the main thing is, again, always trying to have that empathy, because it's one to have it as a skill, but it's also really difficult to immediately discount it and go off and say, this is the right thing to do. But also it's also the shiny object syndrome as well. I think we have so many things in our world today that we tend to gravitate towards, oh, this new technology will solve this problem, or this new gadget or this new digital thing will solve the problem, when in reality, it may add to the problem, and it's really identifying and maybe figuring out a different solution. But I always have that envy, and I think that curiosity is a little bit of part of it as well, as I always want to figure out what that new shiny object is, figure out how it works to see if it does apply to some sort of circumstance. So But I think we all kind of have that shiny object syndrome a little bit.
Oh, yes, we do. And we live in a world that is riddled with shiny objects.
Yes.
And it's becoming more and more prevalent every day. And I think that's why these minimalist guys, who I really like their stuff, their podcast, The Minimalists, I think that's why their message is soaring. It's because there is so much, there's so much abundance, and there's keeping up with the Joneses, you know, trying to impress people that don't really care about us anyway, you know, like things like that. I think that that's one of the reasons that that message is really lifting off, is because we are just inundated, and it's the information overload too. And it's screens everywhere. And, you know, like Golden Krishna says, you know, like 10 steps to unlock your car door when all you need to do is just pull your keys out of your pocket and unlock your door. I just feel like we're just overly fascinated with screens. And,
right.
You know, UX is not just about, it's not just designing a pretty screen. It's way beyond that. And it's cross-channel. It goes beyond.
Yeah, that's a whole nother topic that we could probably spend hours talking about is how the industry has perceived UX as it's grown up and matured. I know we've seen several conversations across the social networks talking about who is a designer, who isn't a designer, and everyone's a designer, and all those conversations. Yes. But also the perception that we've created for ourselves is quite interesting. From we start seeing the evolution of how business rolls into user experience. And I think, you know, early days, everyone associated UX with building wireframes, and they discounted the strategy or the business thinking that involved that. And I think now we're trying to defend that perception a bit more, and hey, get us involved in the beginning a little bit sooner so we can help you craft this experience in the right way versus just creating wireframes after the decision's already been involved. So been a part of a lot of those conversations to try to change that perception inside of organizations. When they start to build these user experience teams, they think, oh, they're just a tactical execution of UX where it's building, you know, wireframes and journey maps and doing these types of things. In reality, it's a much bigger strategic design perspective around, let's craft that experience. Let's ask the why. Let's figure out, and we'll maybe create a solution that you never even thought of. And I think it's in the industry. It's a bit challenging to redefine user experience as we've kind of seen it in the past. And I think once we get to that point, organizations are going to create experiences well beyond they are today. And I think you bring up a interesting topic of conversation that I've had with a lot of companies recently.
Yeah, and it's funny. Just when we start to think we understand what UX is, it changes again.
Yes.
It evolves into something else. Like, I just read an article yesterday about kind of trends in 2018, what we can expect and with UX. And one of the points that was made was UX, what UX means is now transitioning into these new technologies like AR and VR and MR and AI. And so it's like, it seems like that's where UX is shifting. It's just an interesting, I don't know. I can't put my finger on it. Like, you know, I mean, it is ever evolving. That's why I asked that question, you know, like what inspired you to get into this ever evolving field? But I don't know. What is UX, Joe? What does it mean to you?
Yeah.
How much time do we have?
You're putting me on the spot there. I mean, exactly. It's a lot of things. And I think that's the problem right now is it means a lot of things to a lot of different people, depending on their maturity state in the world. And it goes for businesses. It goes for individuals. I worked with a lot of organizations that are tremendously talented at design, but their digital maturity or their user experience maturity was a bit lacking. So it's also where the business is along that scale. But then you mentioned too, all of the plethora of new technologies, which again, goes back to that shiny object syndrome of AR, MR, and all the different things, the AIs, the machine learning, those are going to be a part. And I think that will never change. And I think that us as user experience individuals and customer experience and service design individuals, all those different titles that ultimately create a better experience, we're always going to have those changing, evolving new technologies are going to change how people work. But really the core of the problem is we have to create an experience that solves or meets an unmet user need. And I think no matter how you go about doing that, they're going to have touch points that we know exist today, and they're going to have touch points that we don't know exist tomorrow. So we just have to make sure we build a system that allows them to do that efficiently and try to complete whatever they're trying to complete in a meaningful way. There are going to be ways we can leverage technology that might make that more efficient, but it shouldn't be the core. We shouldn't build an experience around that particular technology if it's not trying to solve a problem to begin with. So I think it's ever evolving, and it will always be that way. And yeah, it's being a part of building an experience that, I mean, I built experiences for the automotive industry before the iPhone came out, plugging in a iPod into your car, sifting through, you know, all your music and driving 75 miles an hour. That was a problem that we had to deal with. And we're dealing with, they called it TUI, VUI, and GUI, tactile, graphical, and voice. Now we're dealing with those same things again with IoT devices like the Amazon Alexa and the Google Home and other types of things. How do you interact with things that don't have screens? How do you interact with things where you're doing multiple things at once, trying to execute those? So I think, again, it goes back to solving the problem, going to be new technologies. It's how we go about doing that, utilizing our experiences and our craft to build those efficiently.
Yeah, that's a pretty deep answer. And I feel like as much as I love Siri, like I love how she helps me sometimes, I actually probably hate her a lot more.
Yes.
Because, and it's funny how like we kind of personify, it's just a machine. It's just a bunch of code. Like, but we kind of personify, and that's by design, right? I mean, she's your personal assistant or whatever, you know, but I'll be honest with you, like probably 85, 90% of the time when I ask Siri to do something, she either makes a pretty big mistake or doesn't do at all what I'm asking. So like I get frustrated with it, but then the other part of me is like, okay, well, we have to get through these growing pains. This is code. This is a lot of code. This is a lot of learning, and the robot's only as smart as the people programming it. And of course the world is full of information. So we have to keep innovating. We have to keep making it smarter. But you wrote a really interesting article called The UX of Ambient Driven Experiences. And I just read that the other night. I thought it was really fascinating, Joe. And it's a lot of it is about kind of where we're heading with kind of these new technologies and like machine learning and facial recognition and tying to, you know, your profile and kind of what you need and even predictive design. Like I was really intrigued by that. I'll be sure to link to it in the show notes, Defenders, so you can check it out. But I started thinking about my Lowe's experience recently. I went to go and try to get a tile job done and to hire a guy to do the tile in my bathroom. And that has been a nightmare. It has been a nightmare experience. And not just because I live in Colorado and it seems like everybody's high around here, especially Lowe's workers.
Yeah.
It's just been a real headache. I think they knew kind of what we wanted already, but then turns out they didn't have enough materials in stock when we needed to buy it. And so now we have to wait or try to find it, the materials in another store, and then just trying to book the contractor. Like that's been a real headache trying to coordinate all this stuff. And I just feel like, man, there's so much room for disruption with things like what you mentioned in the article.
Yeah. And you mentioned a really core piece of the puzzle that I think we're going to start to uncover. And it's been a core, you know, method and approach that user experience had, but we've been so focused, I think, again, on the shiny object. Oh, we need to build this digital experience on the web, on the app, on the phone, or
need an app for that.
Exactly. But we've designed that particular experience without it connecting to all the other touch points that you have. So just like you just described, us as consumers of a product, we go along a journey. We have tons of different touch points. Could be digital, physical, talk to a person, do these different types of things. Companies and organizations have siloed that type of experience. So they've created great apps and great customer experience or customer service, but they haven't joined them all together again. And that's kind of my new role that I'm doing now, is actually thinking more about that system level thinking from a service design perspective. And I think you're going to see that evolution grow even more across businesses, because they've created great experiences in silos. Now they're trying to tie all these touch points together, and they don't know what to call that thing, that holistic experience design. And service design is a part of that. It's an old practice that's coming back again. I think you'll see more of it in the near future. But that, and again, I named it, you know, ambient experience that you have, because now you can pull large amounts of pieces of data, whether coming from sentiment analysis with cameras to the stuff on your phone to, you know, matching, you know, this individual wanted this type of tile, but it's passed along to the customer service person you're talking to. They know exactly what you need, and it all ties together really seamlessly. And I think that's what, you know, I think all organizations want, but it's really, really difficult to build, and it's really difficult to architect. And you kind of have to retrofit some things that they may have put in place to do that. But then now they're trying to think in that holistic end-to-end experience. And even, you know, the workshop I was going to on Monday, we've all heard the term product owners. And I think they're a part of the agile system and, you know, all the processes in place. Well, now we're starting to see the evolution of what's called an experience owner. So the experience owner will own the end-to-end experience that you would have, making sure that customer perspective or the employee touch points are there. So I think you're going to start to see this evolution of a bigger system level thinking experience versus just building an individual app to solve a problem. So you'll still see the apps being built, but they'll be, you know, aware of all the other surroundings around it. I think that's where you'll start to see this, you know, ambient experience type of thing to evolve, which, then again, I've been really interested in, there was, I can't remember the name of the article, but there was a term that they used called centaur design. So obviously we all know what the centaur is, half horse, half human. But applying that to how humans interact with machines. So start thinking at a system level and how we as humans interact with certain types of experiences digitally, and then we co-work together to solve a problem. So you're starting to see that a little bit with how, you know, how people are calling AI that, or maybe machine learning, they're having these humans and computers work together. But the example they showed also was the navigation app Waze. So Waze gives you an algorithm using, you know, GPS and other types of traffic to say, hey, drive in this direction for your destination. But also it gives personal user input if, hey, a traffic here, fog here, other types of things. So it's combining both human experience and knowledge with AI knowledge or machine learning knowledge together to create, you know, a better experience. I think that in itself is going to be where a lot of these experiences are going to start to go. So it's going to add another layer of what we do as user experience individuals to create those. So it's going to be really, really fascinating as we start to see how all of these things tie together in one unified experience that we really want in the end.
Let that marinate a little bit, defenders.
Yeah, I'm still marinating it. So it's quite interesting, but complex too.
Hi, I'm Francisco Enchauste. I'm a designer and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
Interesting stuff. We're definitely living in an age like no other. This is a question I caveat always, and it's a fun one, but I do caveat it because I know you didn't get where you are on your own, and I know you'd be the first to admit that, and you've worked with some incredible people like my boy Cisco and Chaste, episode 24, Defenders, check it out, and RJ also, great, great guy, love RJ. So I want to ask you, Joe, what would your UX superhero name be?
You know, I actually did a little research for this, actually. Go figure. You know, and I stumbled across a very unique name, and it was called the Ultra Synapsis. It is kind of a interesting superhero name that actually, so the definition would be being able to control other people's emotions and insights and empathy to gain their visual vision and perspective and allow them to basically control them, but also understand them. So I think that's probably where I landed as I dove a bit deeper into, you know, what would my superhero name be for this particular podcast. So it's definitely very fitting, I think, once I came across it.
That's awesome, man. And I'm glad you explained that too, because that really helped shed light on it. That's really cool. Love it. Let's wrap up the show, Joe, with imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
I think it goes back to the asking why and being curious. I think you can never ask why enough. So I think that would be one of the main things that I would take away from anybody, you know, in the field that we're doing, either a new green individual or a mature experienced designer. Always asking why is going to get you the core of the problem.
Oh, man. Start with why. And there's my segue into the next question. I'm a reader. I love reading.
Yep.
I recommend Start With Why by Simon Sinek. And of course, The Coaching Habit by Michael Bungay Stainer. I want to ask you, Joe, what would be your one book if you could recommend to our listeners? What would it be and why?
This book's been one I've gone back to since the beginning of my career. And I think I still go back to it today because it has such great, you know, core principles. It's the Alan Cooper book About Face. And I think that one is so deep and so dense. You can use it as a reference. You can read it end to end if you would like, but it's also a reference. I think it has a lot of processes and skills in there that do resonate with today's type of experiences. And again, back to that system level thinking side of things. But I think that would be one. I'm a big podcast person. So this is a little plug for the podcast people. And you probably saw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I actually have a good hour and 20 minute commute every day back and forth. Obviously the lovely Atlanta traffic that we have, but I've actually had quite a routine. So I've actually created a whole plethora of podcasts I listen to on a daily basis, weekly basis. And I actually wrote a blog entry on it, all of it. So I can we can put that in the notes too, to take a gander at it. But
yes,
like I said, I'm a big information nerd when it comes to a wide variety of our industry. So anything technology related or industry related, I'm always adding new ones. I had a great feedback on the blog I wrote, but there's one that, you know, you got to have a little fun in your life every day. And there's one podcast that I've been listening to that resonates with me, and I'm a dad, so there's a lot of dad jokes, but there's also, if you're afraid of swearing or vulgarity, don't listen to this podcast, but you can listen to it on your own by yourself. But it's called The Grumpy Old Geeks. So it resonates with me very well. And if you haven't listened to it, take a listen. They talk about all of our industry and they make some very, very comical kind of commentary on it. So it's one I listen to every day and look forward to listen to. So that would be one that isn't a book, but definitely one to pick up if you guys are interested in podcasts.
Definitely. Definitely. And by the way, thanks for including User Defenders on that, on your great article there.
Of course. It's, you know, there isn't many out there that really from a user experience perspective. So from me, and I think everybody would say thank you for putting together something like this, because I think it has helped the industry grow, individuals grow, and I really appreciate all the work and effort you put into this.
Well, thanks, Joe. Joe, what's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
I think it's simply a Sharpie marker and a piece of paper. I think those two tools generating, you know, as you ask why and you document, and I'm a big person to actually observe. So I'm a big person that goes to the mall and just watches people. But I always observe what people are doing in any setting. And if you ever see me out and about, I usually will have a moleskin and a marker with me, jotting down everything. I think I have quite the library. I'm looking at them now in my office. There's a stack of moleskins that I have that I tend to go through every once in a while that, you know, be able to document some insights that I've gained from some sort of experience that I've had. So I think that, I mean, of any tool would probably be my most powerful one.
That's awesome. Joe, this is my last question for you, and it's one of my favorites. What's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
Yeah, I think we hit on a little bit, and I think the whole theme of the podcast, I think, has been around that empathy side. And
yes,
as a growing, and I've done a lot of kind of mentoring and coaching with some individuals, and one of the things, not only with the empathy side, understanding what their perspective is, of course, asking why, but there's also the whole idea of showing, not telling. And I think understanding how you can start to show and kind of explain what a solution should be is going to bode well in your career, instead of just telling someone that it should be a certain way. And I think you made comment on this too. And it is a very hard thing to really kind of resonate with and kind of use in your career. But if you master that, you will be, one, you'll become a great storyteller, which is another big key of what we do in our industry. But you'll be able to show, you'll be able to show the why of doing a certain experience to someone instead of telling them. So I think that would be another really key asset to learn and always grow. And you can always grow on that one. The showing and not telling is a key aspect of what I do every day. So it's a great one to have. And I encourage everyone to use it more.
Ah, so good. Thankfully, we have seen a huge surge of prototyping tools that are available to us now, accessible to us. And I want to mention Envision Studio that is just on the horizon. In fact, Envision is exclusively sponsoring this season. So I'm so grateful to have them on board. But that tool is certainly shaking things up. And it's not even launched yet, but by the time we record this, but it should be by the time we release this episode. But yeah, thanks to Envision for sponsoring this episode and the show, and also creating Studio, which looks incredible. I can't wait to try it out.
Yeah, me too.
But you know, as far as, you know, the empathy and inspiration, inspiring designers to kind of keep going, to keep fighting on. That's really, and as you touched on, Joe, that's why I do this show. And you know what? I kind of was, you know, I don't reflect enough. I mean, this show is all about, it's about you, Joe. It's about what you're doing, the work you're doing, how you're, you know, helping to change lives with your design and things. But I don't often reflect back on myself, and it's like, why do I do this show? And then it occurred to me, you know why I do this show? It's because the next David Dietz is listening.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
The next David Dietz is listening, and there you, Defender, listening, you might be the one. You might be the one that creates this revolutionary thing that just changes lives radically. That's why I do this. So Joe, as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
Yeah, I think you mentioned earlier the little four-digit or five-letter word that I have is Merle. So you can pretty much follow me anywhere. More active on Twitter, but feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn or any one of those. So look forward to it. Always love chatting with the community. So feel free to hit me up.
Awesome. Yes. And that's Merhl, Defenders.
Yes.
And I will be sure to link to those in the show notes as well. Joe, this has been incredible, man. I'm so inspired. I'm pumped up. I'm ready to go out and kind of take over the world with design, with good design.
That's awesome.
And, you know, that's the point, right? Yeah, man. So I just want to thank you for being here. I know our defenders listening are inspired too. Dude, I just want to put a bow on this right now. And we started off the show with you talking about hockey and how much of a part of your life that is and how many design lessons you've learned actually being involved in hockey and with your kids and coaching them and things. And there's a great quote, and you probably know what I'm about to say, Joe. It's Wayne Gretzky gets the credit for it, but I found out recently that it was actually Wayne's father that said this to him when he was coaching him.
Yep.
He said, "Wayne, don't go where the puck is. Go where it's going."
Yep. Exactly.
And you're doing that, my friend, with all of the innovative stuff you're working on. I just want to encourage you finally to fight on, my friend. I love how Joe's been able to apply his learnings from an entirely unrelated arena, the hockey arena, into his work as a designer. Especially love the takeaways of skating to where the puck is going. He's certainly doing that in his work, and not unlike Arthur C. Clarke, always trying to see what's coming next and stay ahead of the curve to be a part of helping to usher it in. I also especially love the curiosity conversation. I believe that curiosity is largely the precursor to empathy. Any of you defenders with kids understand completely how much you learn about genuine curiosity from your kids. Quick story, my daughter Emery, she's now 4. She asks a ton of questions, and she's definitely a future interviewer. She may even take over my spot here eventually. Who knows? She asked me recently a really interesting question. She asked, "Daddy, why do we drink our spit?" And after nearly spitting out my drink with laughter, I answered her, "That's a great question, baby. It's because it has nowhere else to go." So anyway, just stay curious, defenders. And I think that is the key. And it's probably something that's not talked about enough, I think, in our field. But stay curious. You never know what you're going to find. And tweet your takeaways, defenders. Please talk about the show on Twitter and wherever else you frequent your social media presence. It makes a big difference. It helps other designers discover the show. I don't advertise, so it's all word of mouth, as you will. Oh, man, that was a bad one. I should have the editor put in a ba-dum-psh right there. Anyway, please do that. Talk about it. It really makes a difference. I appreciate you doing that. And get on the newsletter, if you would. UserDefenders.com/join. I send out newsletters in season, biweekly. It's called the Biweekly Bugle. And it's a way for me to tell you who's the most recent super guest, but also to share my usable thoughts with you. You get to read those first there, and I'll publish those at Medium later. And just a way to kind of get to know me and me to get to know you a little more. I'm on the other side of the reply button. So I appreciate those of you on the Biweekly Bugle and encourage you to get on if you haven't already. I want to thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, as always. Thanks, Envision, for supporting this podcast. In 2 weeks, Jeremy Keith is on the show, and he needs no introduction, probably. I'm sure many of you have heard of him. He's been a web pioneer. He's been a part of this from nearly the beginning, and his work has been so instrumental for shaping the web and web design. And so I completely abandoned the normal script, and I just let the conversation go. And what came out at the end was super interesting and actually quite more emotional than I anticipated even. I'm not going to lie. It got a little dusty in the room at the end for me. So look forward to that. And again, thanks so much, Defenders, for listening, for being a part of this journey. You're why I do this. And until next time, fight on, my friends.